Let us fight for a new world, a decent world that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people.
Welcome to Rabble Rants. I'm Santiago Helo Quintero, and alongside Jesse McLean, we're going to unpack the stories that have us most riled up and challenge the narratives around them.
Welcome back to the studio, Mohammed. Before we get started, can you introduce yourself to the audience again?
So I'm Mohammed Ramadan, or Mo. I'm honored to be back with you for a second segment. It feels like I was with you a few days ago, but it's sadly been almost 4 months since we last jumped in together to discuss the frictions that were happening on the northern borders of Palestine and the south of Lebanon between Hezbollah and the Israeli offensive forces. And we discussed the ramifications of those on the region. And here we are again, back again today to navigate more. For those who don't know me, I'm Lebanese from the south of Lebanon. I'm a teacher. I'm a nerd. I'm an activist. I'm a resistance lover. And I'm Palestinian at heart.
Last conversation that we had was wonderful because although it started to just unpack current events, it really did evolve into a conversation about the validity and the power of resistance. This discussion may include that, but I think it's mostly going to focus on the global relations aspect of what is happening right now. So for folks who have unplugged or have not heard, there is escalating tensions, to put it mildly, between Iran and the Zionist state of Israel. On April 1st, now, like October 7th, nothing that we talk about today started on April 1st. However, for newsworthiness, there was a strike in Syria, an Israeli strike against basically an embassy, a political compound belonging to Iran. For those unfamiliar with international law, embassies are one of those untouchables. I know civilians, hospitals, universities, they're all supposed to be untouchable. But for global affairs people, like, the powerful reside in these embassies. So these are really supposed to be off bounds, even for the most evil war hawks, right? They still consider those to be safe grounds. And obviously they weren't and are not. 16 people were killed in the strike, including Iranian senior commander and a brigadier general. For what it's worth, the United Nations condemned the attack. Their condemnations, as we know, they don't do anything.
Condemned and send their prayers.
They hopes and prayers. But, you know, this, again, comes from the global affairs community. So they were actually horrified by the strike. It also damaged the Canadian embassy. Not that you would know, because our foreign affairs minister did not have much to say on it. Of course, she will comment on Iran's following response. But before we get to that, I think it's important to emphasize again, this isn't the first attack on sovereign territory by Israel, hunting down members of the Iranian regime. This isn't even the first time they've killed a high-ranking commander in Syria. This is kind of regular behavior for the Israeli military. It's except this one got a lot of news just simply because of the location that it was at and the fact that it is happening within the context of the siege on Gaza. Mohammed, everyone seems to know just de facto that the United States and Israel consider Iran their mortal enemy. Israel spares no expense harassing Iran with their military, their technology, their, you know, targeting mostly Iran's nuclear program. They consider Iran to be a threat to them. The U.S., the same. Even when we talk about their response here, they always emphasize that they're willing to fight Iran, that it wouldn't take much to trigger them to side with Israel over Iran. Can you help give people some context? Because I think most of the time it's really surface level stuff. We just know that they're enemies, that they don't like each other. And there's a lot of tropes that go with that being an Islamic regime. But it's more than that, isn't it?
Well, look at how the U.S., almost, yes, and Israel and its allies, oversimplify conflicts in the world and paint things in black and white. And I don't know if that's a tactic that is used by colonizers around the world to just keep the masses at bay and keep information tucked away from the general masses. But for decades, generations in the U.S. would grow up under the notion that, well, Iran is the enemy, with zero nuances, zero reading into the history, zero trying to dig in to figure out why. Like, why should we just accept that Iran is the enemy? What is behind that? Why is it a threat to our nation? Why are we not a threat to their nation? And in modern day history, we can trace this back to pre-Iranian revolution, the 1979, when the Islamic Revolution started, and it toppled over the Shah regime, the previous regime that was in Iran, which was an ally to the United States. It was partly one of the hands of the United States in the region. And then in the eyes of the United States, it represented modernization and represented everything that's positive and everything that is progressive in its ideology. And then when the Islamic Revolution, and of course, to simplify it like that is not fair, but to look back and to study the history of the Shah and its rule, his rule within Iran, and how ruthless and aggressive his secret services were, how he dealt with the general population of Iran, boiled over into a revolution in 1979, which took on a religious aspect. And almost most revolutions around the world will at some point take on some form of religious aspect, whether be it the extreme atheist aspect or whether be it a Christian or Muslim or a Buddhist religious aspect. Revolutions will fuel their fire with an ideology. And in Iran, it happened to be the Islamic, especially the Shia ideology.
Sometimes that religion is like this unifying factor. And
It is.
You know, I'm not a big fan of organized religion. I'm just an attempt to explain that youth, that why they pick it up. Like, not only does it add fire and like justification and this moral kind of compass, so to speak, but yeah, it's popular. People know it. And you can, when you speak in it, as many people as possible can listen, you know, and find unity around it if that's the prominent religion, right?
It's means to organize. It's a very efficient means to organize.
As we can see with the Zionist state as well, right?
Yeah, it's a very efficient means to spread news, to spread information, to access resources, and to gather. And we can't fault people to rely on it when it comes to them trying to change over regimes for people to unify in times of revolution. And in 1979, when the U.S. lost its, I'm not going to say its full control, but when it lost its ally in the Shah in Iran, Iran became a big bad wolf. It became the symbol of evil for the United States as a mean of how dare you resist us and how dare you overthrow our ally and do it successfully. Like, Iran since the Islamic Revolution, and I'm not going to speak for the Islamic Revolution as a person who supports the current Islamic regime in Iran, or a person who supports the Islamic Revolution in its part of its brutal aspect. We got to be able to appreciate nuances and appreciate progress that has happened in a country like Iran since the revolution till now. Is it perfect? No. Is there still repression and poverty and secret service police that is brutal and not the healthiest? Yes, there is. But what has Iran been able to do with decades of also economic sanctions that have been imposed on by the West? Become a nuclear superpower, almost become self-sufficient economically, export oil to neighboring countries, export electricity and hydro to neighboring countries.
At face value, that's progress, right? But if you're looking at it from an imperialist U.S. perspective, these are all really bad things. You cannot have that level of self-determination. You can't be a nuclear power if we can't control you.
Yeah. And when you become one, you become the big bad wolf.
Absolutely. Because when you can't control, this happens all the time. People can recognize these patterns in their lives, at workplaces. You know, when someone loses control of something or someone, they then have to delegitimize that entity, right?
And demonize. And almost
their perfectly legitimate state as long as they support us. But everything will be done at that point to bring them down. And if you can't do it with delegitimacy, then you do it with force, right? Then you try to retake control. So yeah, like this is a pattern repeated over and over again. And it's fucked up because people have these levels of state actors and application of international law, right? Like there's some progressive pundits out there that when we're talking, we're going to get into what Iran did in response to that embassy strike. I'm not for state actors going at one another ever, right? The only result is ever death and destruction. That's never the ideal. But if we're going to step back and look at international law and what's and have to hear over and over again that Israel has the right to defend itself, it's so ironic to me that those same people will look at Iran and say, well, not them. That's a terrorist state. So anybody that's sitting there defending their right to retaliate against this clearly illegal strike against them is simply cheering on a terrorist state. Sometimes we actually attach labels to this demonization, right? People throw that word around with no self-reflection. No self-reflection at all, especially when they're talking about entities like the United States, the United Kingdom, Israel in this moment. And they have the nerve to point out the human rights violations that occur within Iran as a means to delegitimize them on the global stage, which defeats the whole purpose of international law if you're just going to have certain people that it applies to and some that are exempt from it. But that is so very typical. But let's get into the response just quickly, because I'm sure most people have heard about it. Let's just give a few of the details. So Iran pretty much tells everyone they're going to respond. They have to.
They gave, I think it was on the first, if not maybe the second, when they publicly came out and said, this is not going to pass without a response. They gave Israel and the U.S. about 13 days. 13 days to empty their embassies, to hide away, which is, when you think about it, is pretty darn graceful.
I imagine there was some attempts during this time to de-escalate politically. You know, phone calls were being made. But in the end, you know, Iran fires off 300 drones, cruise missiles, whatnot.
This is around the time where we started to notice a bit of a wishy-washy change and narrative from the Biden administration in terms of how they were addressing the atrocities that the Israeli government is undertaking, how they're slowly letting go of Bibi or Netanyahu as their idolized baby. And they are, at the end of the day, they're going to use him like as a scapegoat. Like, it's just, he's done for in terms of the American administration. It's a matter of time, but Israel's behaving almost in a tantrum-like childish behavior where it is just unleashing and lashing out anywhere and in any way it can. Syria and Lebanon are being bombed almost on a daily basis. Now, sometimes it's random location. Sometimes it's just the sheer fact of we're going to go into your airspace and drop bombs. In Lebanon, it's a little bit more serious because there's a lot of destruction that's happening. There's a lot of loss of life, loss of infrastructure that's happening. Israel likes to think that there's a lot of losses that are happening to the military infrastructure of Hezbollah. But Hezbollah also has an open border with Syria. So its ability to replenish, unlike the ability of the resistance in Gaza, its ability to replenish has not been hindered. And that's where the attacks on Syria come in. The attacks on Syria come in where Israel tries to sometimes bomb roads that could be used for transporting weapons or could be underground deep, like storing depots or underground or facilities that it knows that possibly there is meetings that could be happening there where we could maybe target a senior official in Hezbollah or on the Syrian side, a Syrian official within the army or within the government. But these attacks have been happening to a sovereign nation. Say what you want about Syria and the Syrian regime and how evil it is or how inhumane it is. As a nation, like, Syria is not at war with Israel. What could be our justification as a world for allowing Israel to just unleash its fury on another nation that's not technically at war with?
You know, I talked about this in an episode not that long ago, maybe even the last Rabble Rants, where I questioned international law. And a nation has so much leeway in terms of the strikes that they can use preemptively. You want to think that it's illegal. You want to think that it's criminal. But the United States or the United Nations does not typically act on any of these things that Mohammed is talking about, because they are considered legal under international law. It's this huge, broad, perception-based law that you need to simply feel threatened. There has to be just the smallest amount of evidence that that would eventually lead to some sort of attack on any one of your interests, not even just your territory, just your interests globally, and you can then take that threat out. So the U.S. drone strikes that they use and Israel's kind of harassment and violence against Lebanon and Iran and Syria, you know, the world justifies those because they follow that mantra that Iran is just this omnipresent threat, this ideological violent threat to all of its Western.
Which then makes you, if you want to look on the other hand, makes you look at the U.S. and all of its military bases spread around the world as a means of, well, these are all our interests. And if at any point we feel threatened anywhere on these 100-something bases.
And that reminds me, and like folks can't forget that now viral speech by Biden, where he's like a younger congressman, and he's standing in front of a crowd talking about how, if Israel didn't exist, the U.S. would create an Israel in order to secure their interests. Or, you know, you ever played Risk? It's like moving pieces, right? If you have a piece on every board within every square, then you then become justified in flexing your muscles to protect those interests. And those interests now, they don't even have to be military bases, because they can be economic interests. So the neoliberalism, that globalism that we've seen spread out, where capital, a lot of U.S. capital, Western capital, is in Africa and the Middle East and
wherever their resources, whatever their natural resources,
wherever they can go, and usually post-war, right? Usually post-destruction is where they're most prominent. And or the poorest nations. And then, you know, you then become justified as a nation state using your military force within those spaces. The reach is far, but still, with all of these things that we're talking about, with all these legalities, still there's folks that look at Iran's response, 99% of which were shot down by the Iron Dome, as illegitimate. Israel, I'm going to try to say this with a straight face. They described this attack that injured almost no one as crossing every red line. They're crossing every red line. Iran is crossing every red line by sending drones they knew would get shot down. Okay, like, Iran is not stupid. They know their capacities. They know Israel's capacities. They know that US and UK forces are on the ready in the area and expecting this launch. In fact, most of us knew it was coming Friday or Saturday, right? Like, I don't know how we all know this, but we know this.
Here's the thing. It's like, we got the news that Iran launched the drones. Sightings of the drones were on social media when they were flying over the airspace of Iraq. Then there was the ETA for the drones.
It had its own theme music. We were all watching.
Which allowed Jordan to close its airspace. Lebanon closed its airspace for precaution. Jordan closed its airspace to intercept. And the Jordanian government came out and said, we will intercept any Iranian drones that are flying over our airspace. Now, that's a completely different conversation to have on the stand of the Jordanian government, who's the Jordanian king, whose wife is Palestinian herself. But that's not something I'm going to open up now, because that's a completely different can of worm to open up. And I'm going to shout out to all the Jordanians that are out on the streets in Jordan in masses and are being arrested in hordes. like, and no one is talking about them. You rarely get it mentioned in the media that the Jordanians actually almost stormed over the Israeli embassy a few weeks ago in Amman. The people of Jordan are proud Palestinian supporters. Most of them are from Palestinian descent. Those drones had, a few hours before they arrived, gave the Iron Dome enough time to prepare itself. And mind you, with zero casualties, the economic casualty that Israel undertook. That $7.3 billion, because we got to also, and something I've mentioned before, you've mentioned multiple times, every interception that the Iron Dome does costs the Iron Dome a few hundred thousand dollars.
And we've talked about drip by drip, you bleed the imperialist machine dry, right? It's piece by piece, because politicians in Israel have to keep justifying these expenditures too. And if they're coming from acts of aggression that could have gone without, right? What are those two commanders to the Iranian regime?
Sadly, replaceable.
An intentional provocation is my point. They wanted to stoke more aggression. It's like they're asking for war, to be honest. And I've seen a lot of people speculate that obviously Israel's going to have to respond. Israel cannot ever not respond with violence. It seems like they're just absolutely refused. It's incapable. I mean, they're not unique in this. The United States often responds in the same way to every provocation. But some are speculating that they'll have to just up the ante, that Israel have to commit something else to actually draw the region into war.
This is where, so we'll talk about, let's segue into talking about the response of Iran, the response of Israel to the drone attacks of Iran. This is now, we're what, on the third day? So and during that time, the amount of shuffling that has happened within Israel on a military level, the few hours of complete silence over Gaza because Israel was overwhelmed with the drone attacks and the ballistic missile attacks that were raining on its skies. Gaza, for once in about 6 months, had no drones. It shows you the effect of the monumental effect of what happened that night. The fact that there's talks now within the Israeli Knesset that the attacks on Rafah, that the Israeli government has been flaunting and trying to push for the last almost month and a half, 2 months, the grand invasion of Rafah. The fact that they're now talking out in public about the fact that it might have to be delayed. And delayed is a nice way to say might not take place.
I feel like a light bulb just went off for me when you said that, though. Because I asked, was like, why? Why would Israel want to be drawn in a war with its neighbors? Perhaps it has to save face here. It's gone too far in Gaza, and the global community, they're getting a lot of pushback.
Well, it's pushed itself into a corner where we love to call it a pariah state at the moment, but they are slowly becoming one.
And they're fighting what I consider an unwinnable battle there.
Yeah.
Yes, it's completely devastating, but I mean, in terms of their described goal of eliminating Hamas.
There's one goal and one goal that if they want to keep fighting, they'll keep fighting to extinguish the life of the 2 million human being that lives in Gaza.
Because that's the only way to stop the Palestinian resistance.
Yep.
Because they're simply creating more need for Palestinian resistance through their action. They're radicalizing more people globally, for fuck's sakes, in this fight to end the occupation. So since they will never, ever erase that Palestinian resistance, and they know that now, they need something else. They need a way out of this so they don't look like they've just done this for nothing.
Drawing their allies in the region into a war is the biggest distraction.
That's right, because the U.S., like when you talked about the wishy-washy, we didn't really get into it a lot. I got some of the statements here that are coming out of the U.S., entity, you know, they've got their UN ambassador Biden make some statements, but they really keep going back and forth, right? They say like, oh, well, Israel really shouldn't respond, but it is up to the Israelis to decide what to do, not us. Like they're trying to really distance themselves from being that puppeteer.
They want to distance themselves also from having to respond with Israel. in conjunction with Israel, as in like hand in hand, this is our response. Because at some point they want to point the finger and say, well, it's Israel who responded. That's on them. Almost that's what it feels like for me. It's like the U.S. is at a point where it almost wants to point the finger and say, well, that's on them. They're behaving like that. Forget about all the help we're giving them, all the cover we've done for them, all the international laws that we have shut down to protect them. This is them doing all this.
Because, yeah, you'll see Biden shifting his language around protecting U.S. interests, not Israel and Israel's people, right? Like as a moral standpoint of solidarity.
Where was that? Where was that from? The fact that Iran flexed. So Iran usually militarily would flex its muscles when they do their military shows in Iran during the celebration of the revolution, where sometimes they would put on display their latest military might. They might show and display a little bit in Syria or in Lebanon through Hezbollah what military capabilities they have, but they never really have shown their ballistic capabilities in the way they did on the night of the 14th, 13th, 14th, to be able to launch those strikes and at the intensity at which, and to sit back and say, you respond, there's tenfolds of this coming your way. And this is where I think the big light bulb moment for the U.S. is we're like, okay, maybe we do need to protect our assets in the region.
And they will have to, right? Not just because they've put their military there, they have economic interests that, you know, financially they don't want to lose, but there's election season coming up and a U.S. president can't lose U.S. interests abroad or appear to be weak on the global stage.
And it's not because they're going to lose physically all of their aspect. It's not a matter of like, it's not the fear that the U.S. is going to like have all of its military bases destroyed or all of a sudden it's going to lose all of its military might in the region. It's the economic fallout of that. It's the global shift that will come after that. And we've seen it already in parts of Europe where talk about Al-Bayt systems, who with the protests, the unrelenting protests that have been happening to them, have started to take steps back and say, okay, we're shifting our manufacturing. We're no longer manufacturing the stuff that is needed for the Israeli army. We're shifting to manufacturing for transports in Europe, the train and metros in Europe. And I was like, the U.S. economic assets will find ways to shift in the region.
But not if they lose that standing as a superpower. That's what you mean about the global shift that could occur, like their fear.
Yeah. And the moment Iran puts that in threat, an actual physical threat, that's where they lose. That's where the U.S. will lose. Not physically, because we can't underestimate the military power that the U.S. has, but economically. More than it's already losing. Like, we're talking about a nation whose people are hungry, crumbling, whose healthcare system is crumbling. But it's finding ways to shuffle money to support its ally in Israel.
Yeah, it'll be interesting how that plays out, because we know more and more people are aware of the economic situation around them and the state of it and the amount of people impacted by it. The U.S. has not really gone into war when they've been so economically desperate, the people, right? It's so much easier to justify that level of war spending and brouhaha when you are the land of prosperity, when you're defending the American dream, right? When you are the ideal to spread out to the rest of the world. But when the people that you're trying to sell that to are experiencing something wholly different at home, U.S. politicians are going to find it harder and harder to justify that level of spending. I mean, the budget for Canadians comes down today, the federal budget, and we are anticipating massive expenditures in things like AI, which will be for the military and the RCMP. Don't think that it won't be, as well as just open defense spending. Defense spending is such a misnomer. Military spending, because we don't defend anything.
What are we defending ourselves from?
No, yeah, it's aggressive spending, and it's done aggressively.
I think this is the time where we need to start shifting our language on all of this.
And I think we are. I feel it. There's one more thing I wanted to open up a little bit, You touched on it just briefly, and so I made a note here and I circled it. And I spoke about that pattern of when you start to lose control of something that you had propped up and shone this spotlight on for so long. When you lose control of that, you start to delegitimize it. And I fear that a lot of political and media narratives around Israel right now focus on Netanyahu. And I've probably been guilty by myself. It's sometimes easier to talk about powers that way by using their leaders and demonizing them. You know, fuck Trudeau bumper stickers come to mind, right? So the way the conservatives here in Canada have been able to paint the problem as a single person, as though it's not the ruling elites that will maintain it, right? And so if you could just get rid of Trudeau, we can all eat again. We can all afford our homes again. And like we know here, the audience knows that's a load of shit, but people fall for it over and over again. And so now we're starting to see the narrative around Israel as replacing Netanyahu. If we could only allow Israel to, the people of Israel, to vote on this, then we could change it all. It's just this crazy maniac like Hitler. Like it was just one man, that he wasn't propped up by a system that reinforced all of these ideas, that had an end goal of imperialist agenda anyway, you know, and so he wasn't representative of the population to an extent, because they are. They aren't these obscure entities that rise through the ranks and maintain power for this long without being representative of the system that they hold up. And so, it would be quite easy for people to just erase how intertwined this occupation and violence is with the Israeli mindset, with the project of Israel itself. It's a colonial mission in itself, right? A modern day colonial mission, really. And it can't be ended, or it won't take a major shift simply by replacing the head. Just like those brigadier generals in Iran. I mean, it's just symbolic.
So there's two points that I want to maybe add on to this. First is the reaction of Netanyahu and his government at the moment to this shift in narrative from the US. Maybe how wild and crazy is he going to get trying to hold on to power? So how hysteric, I think, and I think the more hysteria he can create, the more he could justify him trying to stay in power. If we have not understood at this point that the loss of life for him is unimportant, numbers on papers that don't even matter. The second is the fact that once his time is over, it scares me what comes after. In a state like the state of Israel, where sadly the current Israeli government is not even, like, it's almost being blamed to be closer to the left by the far right in Israel. The rise of extreme fascism in Israel. And the sad part is that it's usually fascism can be seen with an older generation. In Israel, it's the younger generation. What's happened in the last couple of days in the West Bank in terms of settlers going out and raiding villages, burning, killing, destroying. It's just, this I feel is the anarchy that will just happen, and not in a nice way.
I was going to say, we had an anarchist collective on and they were good people. I know what you mean. And I think, like, some people don't realize, we've talked about the West Bank a little bit here, but I don't think people realize the extent of violence that has been happening there continually, like obviously since the occupation started, but I mean that ramped up since October 7th.
And the impoverishment that the Israeli government is trying to do, whether be it trying to stop the banks from accessing funds in the West Bank, because we got to realize that the Israeli government, the central government, central bank in Israel controls the banks that are in the West Bank. So trying to stop them from accessing funds, to trying to control the entry of food.
They've also cut off all the migrant workers. A lot of Palestinians from the West Bank would work within the occupied territories for Israel, and they've all been cut off. They've imported workers from other impoverished nations to fill those boots. And over almost 500 Palestinians have been murdered by settlers or the IDF in the West Bank alone. A place where Hamas is not the authority.
But a place where Palestinian resistance will grow and is growing. Like, it's only a matter of time where the military Palestinian resistance will grow in the West Bank.
Let's hope so.
That's a natural evolution of an anti-settler, anti-capitalist movement. They're left with no choice. They go out and protest. The youth goes out and protest. They throw a few rocks here and there. They carry flags. They chant. They sing. They go out to their olive groves when they're not allowed to. They go out to their farms when they're not allowed to, and they get shut down, and they get killed, and they get their olive groves burnt, and they get their farms flooded with sewage water, and they get the military and the police and the army shooting live ammunition at them. And like, what do you expect at some point? It's a, I was reading the other day, and it brings us back to when the Israeli government released a few prisoners for the return of those few hostages or prisoners with Hamas. And pretty much almost all those that were released in the West Bank were recaptured, if not more. And no one. So this is just a tidbit. Here's a piece of information for you listeners out there
that you didn't ever want to know. But
that's not to think about those that were captured in the West Bank. So they were prisoners from the West Bank that were released in Gaza. So they had no one. They have no one in Gaza. They have no families. But when they did the exchange, they released them on purpose in Gaza, knowing that they're releasing them into an open air cesspool of genocide.
And just like removed from their community, possibly within like another faction, you know, they're just trying to create like as much instability,
damage.
And terror to those people as possible.
Yeah. But Israel will go to the United Nations and complain that Iran attacks its airspace. And
I know I shouldn't be surprised, and I definitely shouldn't be laughing, but it is fucking comical. Like, I'm thinking of the person who was drafting this letter that they sent to 32 other states.
I don't know how they do it. I don't know how they do it in all seriousness.
They must get their AI to do it, because who could put that shit together where you, with a straight face, you're, while committing genocide, and this same global community, the same body, has declared the fact that you know, people shouldn't be selling arms to you anymore. They have said that you need to stop your aggressions on Palestinians. Like, there have been rulings here in the Security Council, the Human Rights Council, and the UN has made all its declarations or whatnot. And you still come back to this community and you say, you folks need to be sanctioning more. People can't forget that Iran already has so many economic sanctions on it, and Israel would like there to be more. So they're basically, and you couldn't possibly economically sanction them any more than you already do. So really, they're calling for armed aggression. They actually went to the global community and said, you need to really defend us against this retaliation. And what do they expect the response to be? I understand what the back rooms might be. I get it. Like, these fucking imperialists working together. But they still have front-facing audiences. They can't just be like, oh, yeah, like, well, Melanie Jolie, she doesn't give a shit. She comes down and she says, how could Iran do this? Like, I fear for the people of Israel suffering their anxiety attacks during these raids. As a sufferer of anxiety, I feel like I hear the ableism in my statement there, but it's just, it seems really messed up that folks still could just take themselves or expect people to take them seriously while repeating this shit. I just like how far can you go before you know everyone's going to laugh at you, that you just can't even say it anymore? Just stop saying it.
As long as you're finding an audience that's regurgitating it, which sadly they're still finding an audience to regurgitate it.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's where the fight is a long one. Our anti-imperialist fight is not one that's going to be won in a month or two or 6 months or years. It's a long one. And it's about educating and counter-educating and re-educating and re-educating. And it burns you out. And we talked about it. We feel the burnout out of 6 months of heavy work. Let alone think about those revolutionaries who dedicated their life. I'm reading the beautiful book by Wissam Rafidi, The Trinity of Fundamentals. It's a bit of an autobiography that he did, and he was part of the Palestinian liberation movement. And then he was pretty much asked to go incognito, go into hiding. And he dedicated his life. And then he got captured and he was in prison. And he wrote this book in prison. And this book was smuggled out of prison in forms of tiny transcripts that were swollen and taken out of prison. He talks about, he touches about the fact that it's a long fight.
I mean, that's hard to hear, even though I understand it's the reality. And it makes me doubly appreciative that you took the time to come in and help educate and re-educate so that we can do our part.
Well, I am honored. I'm honored and I'm just thankful for you having created the space and to have offered this platform to allow people like me to share, even if it's random pieces of information left, right, and center. I'm as unorganized mentally as unorganized can be.
Well, the show is also an ADHD support group.
Honestly, and I've been finding it harder and harder to organize mentally lately. Those last 6 months, the sheer bombardment of information. And I sat a small tidbit of my personal life. I was on the phone reading articles and keeping up with the news while sitting at a hockey banquet where both of my boys were recognized for their accomplishment throughout the hockey season. So while my kids were receiving awards, I'm not being able to shut down fully and my intake of information because I feel like this is beyond my personal life. It's beyond my enjoyment and my family. It's a sacrifice that we have to take and we have to do.
Well, that's it for another Rabble Rants. If you enjoyed it, make sure you share that with a comrade. Our work is 100% supported by the community, so if you can, please consider becoming a monthly patron. We've put links in the show notes. And whatever you do, keep on disrupting. Whatever you do, keep on disrupting and keep each other safe. Thanks for listening.